Thank you. So my current employer really wanted you to say BT there. I mean, they really did. Oh, man. Did
BT counterpart.
Thank you.
Wow.
I don't care, but they... matters a lot to them. So, hi, thank you. Thanks for coming. Welcome. There's a lot of you. It's one of me. This should work out okay. What I want to talk about is security. But not sort of in the way that I might normally talk about. I want to talk about tech. I want to talk about the feeling and reality of security. And I entitled this talk Reconceptualizing Security, because I think we need to start thinking about security differently. Or at least I think if we think about it differently, we're going to do a lot better than if we think about it as we used to think about it. So security is really two different things, right? It's a feeling and it's a reality. And they're different. So you can feel secure even though you're not. And you can be secure even though you don't feel it. I mean, really we have a language issue, right? We really need two different words to talk about these two completely different concepts. Right? So I want to talk about thinking it in terms of those concepts, to separate the feeling from the reality, and to understand when we're talking about one or the other, and to look at the two of them to find out and figure out when and why they diverge, how we can make them converge. Right? And again, the language will fail us again and again, because there really aren't the words to talk about the concepts that we need to talk about. But we're going to give it a go. So, I guess my career has been sort of what I call an endless series of generalizations. I started out doing work on mathematical security cryptography, did work in computer security and network security. My latest book, Beyond Fear, talks about general system security, airlines and terrorism and crime and sort of all those other things. A couple of years ago, I started looking at the economics of security. And it actually, it's real interesting. It turns out lots of problems that sort of make no sense from a technical point of view make perfect sense when you look at them from an economic point of view. And this is more about the psychology of security. And it turns out there's a lot out there that I never knew about, and as technologists, well, we'd never see. And it's a convergence of a lot of different areas of research, of clinical psychology, of behavioral economics, of neurobiology, evolutionary psychology, evolutionary biology, philosophy, sociology. I mean, they're putting people in NMR scanners and sort of making them afraid and see what happens in the brain. I mean, that kind of stuff's going. It's really interesting. So step back to economics for a second. Economics views security as a trade-off. And this is something I've been saying, since 2000 or before. Right? There's no such thing as absolute security. And any security you get always involves trade-offs. Right? You give something up, you know, and either it's money or time or convenience or, you know, a feature set or some fundamental civil liberties or whatever. Right? And you get some security. You can't keep that jacket. Right. I mean, I remember, you know, even in the month after September 11th, a reporter asked me, how can we stop this from ever happening again? And I said, well, that's easy. Just ban all the aircraft. Right? I mean, you laugh, but if you think about it, that's exactly what the U.S. government did in the days after the attacks. It took every plane out of the sky because we didn't know what was going on, what the extent was. It was a huge trade-off that we'd never do long-term, but it was perfectly reasonable at that time. Right? Security is a trade-off. You know, as a kid, I had an aunt and uncle that lived in a gated community. I don't know if you have them here in Australia, but this is sort of a community that had walls and a guard. You'd have to have a reason to go into the neighborhood. It was a gated neighborhood. Right? And these people gave up some freedom of movement and some privacy for security. Right? So security is always a trade-off. And you, me, all of us, are security consumers. Right? That's the way we should think of ourselves. So the question isn't, you know, does this thing make you more secure? Right, forever in the U.S., we hear from the people who are in favor of this sort of thing, the world is a safer place because Saddam Hussein is not in power. That may be true, but it really is not the right, it's not the point. The question isn't, are we safe or not? The question is it worth it? Right? Is it worth the whatever trillion dollars, or not, I think hundreds of billion, whatever the number is, you know, the thousands of losses of lives, the credibility in the world stage, was paying all of that worth what we got? Right? That's the question. And you could debate it, but that's the right question. Now, I'll give you another example. I mean, none of you here are wearing a bulletproof vest. I'm pretty sure of that. It's not because they don't work. They work great. It's because for you guys living in, you know, Melbourne, wherever you live in Australia, it's not worth the trade-off. It's not worth the cost, the loss of fashion sense, you know, whatever it is you'd be giving up to get that security. Right? Security is a trade-off. And we all have a natural intuition about these trade-offs. I think this is real important. Right? Making security trade-offs is something we do multiple times a day, mostly unconsciously. Right? It's fundamental to being alive. Everybody does it. Every species does it. Right? You can imagine imagine a rabbit in a field eating grass, right? And the rabbit sees a fox, or I guess a dingo out here, right? And the rabbit's going to make a security trade-off. Should I stay or should I flee? And the rabbits that are good at making that trade-off tend to live and reproduce, while the rabbits that are bad at it tend to get eaten or starve, right? So you'd expect, being a successful species on the planet, human beings would be really, really good at making these trade-offs. Right? At the same time, we're hopelessly bad at it. Right? That, to me, is a fundamentally interesting question. Right? Why is that true? Well, you know, the meta answer is that we respond to the feeling of security rather than the reality. I'll sort of give you some examples. I mean, these are biases in risk perception. There are psychological studies that demonstrate all of these, and I'll just sort of go through them. I mentioned some of them in Beyond Fear, even the book before. So here's some basic biases. People exaggerate spectacular and rare risks and downplay common risks, right? Flying versus driving, obvious one. The unknown is perceived to be riskier than the familiar. In the United States, kidnapping is much more common by relatives than by strangers, but people feel exactly the reverse. They are afraid of kidnapping by strangers. Personified risks are perceived to be greater than anonymous risks. Osama bin Laden is more dangerous because he has a name. Right? People fear him more. People overestimate involuntary risks and underestimate voluntary risks. Right, earthquakes versus, I don't know, smoking or skydiving, right? Risks that people take. Now, it's funny, just this morning I saw an article in magazine Psychology Today that listed 10 of these. I'm going to blog it probably next week. So if you sort of go, you'll see it. And these are all bias. These are all mistakes we make about risk perception. Right, so feeling and reality diverge. But most of the time, these brain heuristics work, right? Most of the time, they're pretty good. I mean, because we've developed these because they make evolutionary sense. And there's another essay I sort of recommend to you, which I wrote on the psychology of security, where I go through a lot of studies. It's actually fascinating research, sort of on security and how we misperceive it. If you just go to Google and type psychology of security, it's the first hit. And that's sort of that's an essay of mine. So on this topic, I'm going to sort of quickly go through. Right, most of the time, feeling and reality are the same, certainly true in prehistory. Right, the more exact answer as to why we get this wrong so much is that the human brain is amazingly optimized to deal with the security risks endemic to living in small family groups in the East African highlands in 100,000 BC. We're really good at that. Right, 2008 Melbourne, not so much. Right, our brains, our society's evolving faster than our species. Right, modern times are harder. Technology makes it harder, and the media makes it harder. Right, I mean, in really interesting and subtle ways. There's a lot of research on this. I really urge you to pull out my Psychology of Security essay. And also, I think the Psychology Today article is a really good one. So what happens when the feeling and reality, you know, get out of whack, right, when they diverge? Well, a couple of things happen. A couple of things could happen. When the reality is low and the feeling is high, we get a false sense of security. Right? We think we're more secure than we are. When the reality is high and the feeling is low, we get, I don't know, irrational fears, right? Maybe paranoia. Right? So we're more scared than we should be. You know, and you know, for years I would write about, as a technologist, products that address the feeling of security, but not the reality. Right? I'd call them snake oil. I call it security theater. Right? This is stuff that directly addresses the feeling without actually doing anything about the reality. I mean, but you know, I don't know what to call products that address the reality of security but not the feeling. Right? Is it your guardian angel? I mean, I sort of think about what we expect like the CIA to do, right? To sort of go out and neutralize security threats but never tell us. Right? Fix the reality but ignore the feeling. There's no real word though. But that's important because, you know, there is stuff that does that. All right, so let's get back to economics. So economics is what drives security, right? If security is a trade-off, if you are security consumers and you're balancing costs and benefits, right, when you look at security, you're going to look at the cost of security and the benefits of security, or the cost of the insecurity and the benefits of the insecurity, and you're going to make the trade-off. So there's some cost to security failures, you know, sort of in the IT space. It costs money, theft of proprietary information, regulatory noncompliance, at least in the US and Europe, I know most about those regulations. Bad press, certainly. Right? If you have bad security, you're going to be laughed about in the newspapers. You might lose customers, unless you're a monopoly, in which case it's harder. Right? But these are all costs to security failures. There's also a cost to security. Again, sort of think of IT. Security costs money. Right? You're going to have to pay for evaluations and design. It'll certainly cost convenience. Your products will have fewer features, less functionality. There'll be a slower time to market. Right? Your profits will be less. Right? So there are these real security costs to having security. And these economic considerations, whether you're a software vendor, whether you're an end user, drive security. Right? But here's what's interesting. People make the trade-off based on the feeling of security, not the reality. Right? So the economic incentives are for companies to make people feel secure. Right? That's where you're rewarded in the market. Now, of course, there are two ways to do this. Right? You can make people just feel secure and ignore reality, right? And that's snake oil, that's security theater. Or you can make people actually secure and hope they notice. Right? So I guess make people really secure and hope they don't notice. Sorry, make people feel secure and hope they don't notice. Or make people actually secure and hope they notice. Right? Those are basically your options. Now, sometimes people notice. Right? And people notice when there's enough information out there, when there are enough positive and negative examples that you can say, oh yeah, this is working. Right? If I sell you a door lock and it doesn't work, right, eventually, I mean, you'll hear this lock doesn't work. Maybe you'll get robbed, your neighbor will get robbed. There'll be enough news that you'll say, well, this thing doesn't work. Or if my new door lock works great, maybe you'll notice the crime in the neighborhood is reduced. Right? If there's enough information about attacks, whether successful or unsuccessful, people will get the information to notice that the reality of security is changing, and then their feeling will change. You know, also if there's not too much emotion clouding this information. Right? Because the one thing we haven't talked about yet is security is very emotional.
Right? So it's not enough, there's not too much emotion, you're going to learn from the information.
So security theater is exposed when it's obvious that it's not working. Right? That's how you expose it.
So sometimes people notice. Sometimes they don't. And, you know, as far as we're concerned, way too often they don't. Right? And why? Well, there are a bunch of reasons, right? Poor understanding of risks. Right? People don't understand the risks properly. Poor understanding of costs. Right? People either over or underestimate the costs or defer them somehow. I mean, a lot of the problems with the United States and the Iraqi war is the citizens not understanding what the huge cost would be. Not a good understanding of the countermeasure and how it works and how effective it is. And that could be a problem. And of course, people with specific agendas will contribute to this misunderstanding. Right? It might be in someone's best interest, either a political party or a company or an industry, to convince you that, you know, something works better or worse than it does. Right? I'm thinking of national ID cards or cameras. I mean, there are industries that are pushing these things, even though there's data saying they're not very effective. Right? There's also the inherent problem of low probability events. Remember, the best way for people to understand the difference of feeling reality is to get the information. But if events are so rare, the information's not going to be there. I mean, you know, things I can sell you that'll help prevent, you know, airplane terrorism, well, maybe I've been pushing since September 11th, well, there hasn't been any incidents. Right? We don't know if sky marshals, if, you know, screening shoes, I mean, like some of the silly ones, are effective because there isn't the data. Right? We can't say, look, sky marshals stopped this attempt, or this terrorist thing happened even though there were sky marshals. There's no data. Which makes it harder, right, to get that feeling and reality converging. Can someone hand me a pen? Appreciate that. So when people don't notice, right, when people don't notice that the feeling reality change, I'm going to make a quick note of my talk. When people don't notice, you get something that economists call a lemons market. So let me explain what this is. And this is something worth understanding. This is a useful piece of economics even outside of security. The work was done by an economist, George Akerlof. He's at University of California, Berkeley. And he actually won a Nobel Prize for this work. And what he looked at is markets where there's an asymmetric information between buyer and seller. Where the seller knows a lot more about the product than the buyer. I don't know if this piece of American slang has gotten to Australia, but a lemon is slang for a car that doesn't run well. Right? It's a lousy used car. Right? And the reason there is this slang is because the buyer of the car doesn't know anything about the cars. Right? So the seller can sell him a lemon without him knowing it. Right? So the seller has more information on the quality of the cars than the buyer. So Akerlof looked at these sorts of markets. And I mean, this research is both theoretical, there are economic models, there's economic studies, controlled experiments, and actually looking at real world situations. And the conclusions are all the same. So, you know, sort of look at this is Akerlof's basic thought experiment. Suppose a town has 100 used cars for sale, right? 50 good cars worth $2,000 and 50 lemons worth $1,000. What happens in this market? Well, the equilibrium price for cars, and I'll sort of spare you the math, but although it's pretty basic, is $1,500, right? That's where prices converge. And at that price, no good cars sell and only lemons sell. Right? That's what happens. What Akerlof demonstrated, and many after him have also shown, is that in markets where the seller knows a lot more about the quality of the product than the buyer, bad products drive good products out of the market. Right? And this is very, very much the security market. Right? Think of IT. Right? Think of the firewall market. And those have been around long enough. Remember when there were dozens, about 100 different firewalls.
The winners weren't the best ones. Right? They weren't the most secure ones. Or the IDS market.
Pretty much any product, any security product out there. And because I can hold up two, let's say I'm holding up two VPNs.
Right, and they have the same capabilities, have the same buzzwords, use the same algorithms, use the same protocols.
One is very, very well designed, methodically made secure, tested rigorously. And the other one has just been thrown together.
Right, and you can't tell the difference.
Right, you're going to buy the cheaper one. Right, and the good product won't get the market share. Right, because the buyer has no way of telling. There's no way of valuing all the work the seller put into making that product secure, good, you know, reliable, whatever. So what happens in these sorts of markets is that buyers resort on what economists call signals. And a signal is a way that a buyer can tell the seller, hey, my product's actually better than the other one, even though you can't tell. So in a used car market, a very common signal is a warranty. Right, a money-back guarantee. The buyer says, all right, take the car, drive it for a month.
If you don't like it, bring it back, I'll give you your money back.
Right, that's the buyer saying, you know, I'm not selling you a lemon,
but you can't tell, and I can't make you believe me, so I'm going to put this warranty in place so you can buy it sure that if it is a lemon, you can give it back.
Right, that's called a signal. We don't do warranties in IT. A more common signal is company reputation. Right? In the 70s, the saying was, nobody ever got fired for buying IBM. Right? That was a market signal. The reputation of the company meant that as a buyer, you felt like you could be sure that you get a quality product, even though you had no clue how to evaluate one product from the other. Right?
Certifications are also a signal,
either government certification or commercial. Product reviews, product comparisons, testimonials, trusted recommenders. Gartner is a major signal in the IT space. Lots of companies buy products that Gartner says come from good companies. Right? You know, I can be a signal. I wrote an article about a month ago on laptop security. I said I use PGP Disk. Well, for a bunch of people, they'd say, oh, wow, Bruce uses it. It must be good. Right? That's a signal. The buyer says, I don't know what's good and what's not. I trust Bruce, therefore, I'm going to trust the product he uses. Right? That's the way a signal works. Right? For some people, open source is a signal. For some people, proprietary is a signal. Right? Open source is a signal the other way. You know, we've all read articles from people who say, you know, don't buy open source, that's insecure. Right, you know, and I write articles saying, you know, open source is secure. Right, so signals can go either way.
Right, and that's important because signals can be manipulated.
When you think of all of these, company reputation, certifications, product reviews, testimonials, product comparisons, trusted recommenders, right, these signals are all sloppy. They can be manipulated by people who want you to believe one thing or another.
Right, you know, marketing can manipulate signals.
Right, lots of times you go to trade show floors and you go to a company's booth and they show you the awards they got and they show you customer testimonials. I mean, these are all manipulated signals. Right, they're being selectively shown to you so you might believe them. Right, politics is all full of manipulating signals. Certainly US politics, you guys have had your share. I'm being snuck up on. It's my bag. I didn't know. I never had a bag. My bag's over there. Pardon me while I get a bag. Why are you here?
I was going to give it to Donna.
Oh, okay. All right. I'm clearly not doing this right. And there she goes again. Anyway. Right, signals are manipulatable and they're manipulated. right? You know, the problem is exacerbated by a lot of things. You know, a lot of the security we do is sort of outsourced, right? We outsource our terrorism risk management to our government, right? We outsource other pieces of security to different organizations. And these all often have, you know, agendas, right? So they, it's in their interest to manipulate signals. And again, right, they're dinking with our feeling of security in hopes that it stays diverged from the reality in a way that's advantageous to them, right? That's what happens. And the result, of course, is bad security, right? That's what you end up with, right? You know, most counterterrorism policy on this planet, it's an example. You know, right, people not buying enough computer network security or buying the wrong things, right? And so on, I mean, lots of examples. So how do you fix this? Right, what's the methodology to fix this? Well, in the business world, information is how the problem fixes itself, right? I mean, that's how the problem fixes. In the business world, if there's enough information, you get this natural convergence between feeling and reality. Right? Because companies that get it wrong either spend too much money on security, right, and they're sort of overspending and they're not profitable enough, or they're spending too little on security and their risk is higher and bad things happen to them and they're not profitable enough. Right, so in the business world, there is this natural convergence with information. I mean, you still have what's called the optimism bias to worry about, right? Very rare events and events with very high costs. I mean, sort of here's the math, right? You know, normally a business will calculate risk on something called annualized loss expectancy, right? So you take the percent chance you'll get whacked by the cost to you if you do get whacked, and that tells you how much you should spend. Right, so if you have, I don't know, a 1 in 10 chance of getting your store robbed, and if a robber will steal $1,000 when they rob your store, you should spend $100 on security each year, right? If you spend more, you're spending too much. And if you spend less, you're spending too little and it'll cost you too much. Right, so there's that sweet spot. The problem is, right, when you multiply zero, right, an event that's probability of zero, with infinity, with the damage of infinity. And if you've studied infinity theory, which I actually don't recommend, zero times infinity equals every number. Right? You can make that product equal whatever you want. This is why when security companies give you cost justifications, they're complete bullshit. Right? Because you can jigger these things just a little bit. And you can make that middle number be any number you want. Right? There's a real problem with very rare, very devastating events. Right, but that's business. In the world of individuals, it's even harder because there's often too much feeling, too much emotion, too much fear for this to work properly. Right? Fear is very basic. When you start reading about how humans deal with fear, our fear organ in our brain is called the amygdala. And it is a small almond-shaped part of your brain. It's sort of back here. It's at the base of your brain stem. It first evolved in primitive fishes, and it's how you feel fear. It controls basically the fight or flight instinct. So increased heart rate, sweaty palms, increased muscle tension, that's all the amygdala. And they'll put people in brain scan machines and show them like pictures of snakes and stuff. And the amygdala is already feeling the fear before your conscious part of your brain registers that you've seen a snake. Right? This is way faster than consciousness. And it's very hard to override. Right, one of the great benefits of being human is that we get to override our fear. You know, maybe we want to stand there and throw a spear at the woolly mammoth as it's charging at us, right? Instead of running away, which is what our body is telling us to do with pretty much every cell of our being. right? Or more modern, maybe we want to stand there and get yelled at by our boss and not stab him. Which is also being conveyed with every cell of our being, right? That is your neocortex, right, this part of the brain, the human part of your brain, overriding the fish part of your brain, right? And this is why we could all sit here calmly, you know, even though who knows what's going on in your guys' heads, right?
Right, so security is a lot of feeling. And even in the face of information, it might not be enough to overcome feeling. You might need to overcome feeling with feeling. Right? You know, if you feel fear, I'm going to make you better by making you feel less fear. And this is important. Now, for most of my career, I would insult security theater and snake oil, right, as being, you know, as dumb. But in fact, they're not, because both the feeling and reality of security are important. Right? That the problem isn't stuff that just addresses the feeling, but the problem is when the two diverge. Right? That's what causes problems. And as system designers, we need to address both. We can't ignore one. Right? I'll give you two examples. In the United States, in the 1980s, I think, there was a little rash of non-prescription drug poisonings, particularly Tylenol. Somebody, this is just so weird when I explain it, would take a bottle of Tylenol off the shelf, would put poison in it, and put it back on the shelf. And some random person would buy it, take it home, and get sick or die. And this is just, I mean, this is really antisocial behavior. So it doesn't take more than a few of these before the entire American public's terrified of buying over-the-counter drugs. And Tylenol says, oh my God, my entire business model is collapsing. I must do something. So what they do is they invent something called the tamper-proof cap. And presumably all the drugs you bought over the counter here have them as well. Right, you know, it's a cap when you break it, you know that the drug hasn't been tampered with, and you know you can take it with impunity. That's why it exists. And that security measure saves Tylenol and the whole industry. So as a homework assignment, I'll sort of make you can think of 10 ways to defeat this silly security device. I'll give you one example, a syringe. Right, it is basically non-effectual. It only addresses the feeling of security. But because people were so scared, that's what needed to be addressed. And that was a perfectly reasonable thing to do. I'll give you another example. In the United States, it's very common that in hospitals, in maternity wards, that babies are given little RFID wrist tags, babies and mothers. And so if someone other than the mother tries to take the baby outside, you know, whatever the door to the maternity ward is, the alarm goes off. Right? So this is an attempt to deal with baby theft, which actually, if you read about the literature, never happens. Right? It is not a problem anybody has to worry about. But I assure you, if you're a nurse and you're going to a new mother and saying, I have to take your baby away and out of your sight to run these very important tests, you better have a whole lot of security theater, or you're going to get your arm ripped off. Right? So again, this is a measure that addresses the feeling, but not the reality, but an extremely important feeling that if you didn't address, you'd have much greater problems. So this is basically my point. Right? That when we pull apart feeling and reality, we suddenly notice that they're both important and that ignoring one won't help. Right? If I build a product that, you know, let's say my great computer security product, and it makes you all secure, and nobody realizes it, no one's going to buy it. Right? What they'll do is they'll buy, the browser that puts a little green key in the lower left-hand corner. There's little green key. Hey, I'm secure. Right? That's what they're going to buy.
So that's really what I want to say. And I actually really want to take questions. This is still very new stuff. So there's a question over there. And there might be microphones.
I was just going to suggest if people have questions, it's a bit hard to get out, but if you can get out, if you could come down the front, that would make it a little bit easier.
All right, while they do that, I'll start with you. You can stand right there.
Okay. I have a very short question.
Short question. No, yes. 13.
How do you separate feeling and reality in airline security, and how do you see airline security in 5 years?
In airline, so airline security is pretty much all about feeling. I mean, I'll sort of give you a couple of stories. In the months after September 11th, in the United States, we had National Guard troops in airports. If you traveled to the U.S., you saw them. They were wearing uniforms, sort of inside security, carrying these big rifles. Those rifles had no bullets, which is probably for the best. They're like 20, and I wouldn't want them to have big guns in airports. It seemed like a disaster all around. Right? That addressed the feeling of security. A lot of what we see addresses the feeling, not the reality. And you know it's true because they address the threats that we know about. Right? You know, they address the shoe bomber because he hit the press. They address the liquid bombers because they hit the press. And they're not even very effective at those things. So airline security is largely security theater, right? Largely it tries to address the feeling, not the reality. But people are wising up. I mean, there's a whole lot of derision. I'm going to blog this, I think, tomorrow, a study, and this kind of annoyed the TSA United States, that they are less trusted than the U.S. Tax Authority. So there's this letter by Kip Hawley, who runs the TSA, to his employees. This letter leaked a couple of days ago, where he's like moaning this fact. And it's like, duh, can't you figure this out? So, I mean, it's sort of weird. Most airline security is security theater. On the other hand, most airline security, there isn't the threat isn't so big. So it's a lot of waste of money, but it's all right. In 5 years, I expect nothing to change. You know, I expect things to change in 10, 20 years. You know, security ebbs and flows, and we're still in the we'll be scared. You know, that's gonna go back. For those interested, I don't know if people read this. I did an interview with Kip Hawley, who runs the TSA United States. It's really interesting. I get to ask him all sorts of questions he hated answering or tried not to answer. We talked about ID cards, talked about liquids. I listed half a dozen ways to, you can hijack airplanes that he's not dealing with. We talked about all sorts of things. It's a fun, fun interview. I guess the Schneier Hawley interview in Google will get it. I really enjoy doing it. I'm not sure he enjoyed it that much, but it is worth reading.
One argument against security is it is not measurable. You cannot measure it. And some people in the Linux community use that to say, it's difficult to figure out which security is the right way, which access control mechanism or whatever. So. Seems to bode well with your argument that this is an emotional thing. How would you go against that? And one comment, I guess that tamper-proof, if you put pressure air or vacuum it, that circumvents your syringe problem.
Only if people notice. I'm willing to bet last time you opened tamper-proof cap, you didn't check that.
I did that.
All right. I got other mechanisms to deal with you. Right, so it isn't always hard to measure. I mean, we can know exactly the crime rate on campus. Right, we can find whatever security office there is at this university and find out exactly what your risk of being mugged or attacked tonight walking around campus. Right, we have the data. In IT, you're right, there isn't a lot of data. We don't, and this is one of the problems we have, because our bosses ask us all the time, what's the risk? What's the data? And we just don't have it. And that makes it very, very hard. Right? We don't have the data because people don't report. We don't have the data because people often don't know they've been attacked. And we just don't have that data. So you have to rely on emotion, but you don't have the data. So, I mean, I don't have a good answer because I want the data too. But yes, that's true. In a lot of cases, we don't have it.
Regarding companies asking you to distort the market signal, without naming names, you have a good anecdote of a company that asked you to endorse a product that...
Well, I get asked to endorse things all the time, but let's personal and then sort of look at all the stuff out there about security cameras. Right? The camera companies are pushing it. They're making very emotional sorts of propaganda. They're giving it away. In the United States, there are schools that have cameras in place because the technology's been given to them by the camera companies. There are police chiefs that talk about how good they are. All the actual data goes the other way. But here are companies poised to make an enormous amount of money, pushing cameras. And it's something that, naively, oh yeah, cameras, I feel safer, right? Right, that people resonate with. So there's an example of an industry. RFID cards is another industry that's really pushing RFID for security. And they're also very much distorting research and the facts. So they're just two examples. I get asked to endorse things all the time. I basically endorse nothing. I don't like it just because, I have to do the research to satisfy myself, the self that it was actually good, and I don't have the time to do that. So I don't want to go. It's not like endorsing like Wheaties. This tastes good, right? You just have a bowl, you taste it. Yeah, it tastes good. Right? It's very hard to evaluate non-functional requirements. Right? I can say, boy, I like this watch. It tells the time. Great. Right? But to say it's reliable, I got to wear it for 5 years and maybe do some testing. It's a very different sort of endorsement. And security's like that. I know if I worked in a different field, I can get better endorsements, but security is harder.
Sorry, I just wanted to say that after this, we're not going to have time for more questions. So once we've got to the end here, that's it.
In your maternity ward example, you are safe because of real measures like background checks and registration and whatnot, and you feel safe because of the RFID tag. How do you stop the security theater that's bringing your feeling of safety in line with the reality from taking over, and in 5 years' time they don't bother doing background checks, but we still feel really safe because we have RFID tags.
And this is a problem, right? This is what we're all fighting with terrorism policy. How do you stop the stupid stuff and get stuff that's good? The way to deal with this is information. Right? The way to make people notice that feeling and reality have not converged is by information. What I personally try to do is write and speak and say, hey, right, the emperor has no clothes. Right, this isn't helping. You think it is, but it isn't. It's hard. Sometimes you can't do it. And I think with sort of terrorism policy, especially in the United States, it's going to take a generation for younger people to start figuring out what's going on. And I'm fighting a losing battle. So sometimes I think you can't. It's kind of frustrating. But I don't think it's always possible. But where it is possible, information will do it. Right? You have to go into someone's brain and say, here's the automatic fear pathway, stop. Put a brake in and pay attention. And then maybe you can get people to get beyond their fears. It doesn't always work, but that's how you're going to do it if you do it.
I think my question's related to a lot of, these are all sort of cost trade-off questions, but thinking about us as producers of software which should be secure enough, is it always going to be, do you think, an enormously expensive process to make feeling and reality converge? So if you're a small business or a hobbyist producing a piece of software that needs to have X amount of security, is it always going to be out of our hands to convince people that the reality is enough to assuage their feelings and so on? So it seems you're sort of, you've been talking about very expensive things like brain scans and degrees in economics or huge amounts of reading in economics. And in some ways, as small producers of software, some of that stuff is out of our reach.
Yeah. In software, certainly. We know very little about software security. We don't have proofs and rigorous methodology. We can't even prove a program terminates at any reasonable size, let alone that it's secure, right? So it's always tricks. And there really are, there's lots of good books on designing secure software and how to do it and the methodologies. It is. It's very hard and very expensive. Look at the way software designed for commercial aircraft. It's an extremely expensive methodology because it's very, very
safety conscious. Right? It's very well designed to be reliable, to be safe, to be so that everyone knows what it'll do. And in the absence of a theory, all you can do is put a lot of effort on doing your best. And unfortunately, yes. I mean, it really is, I think, for the foreseeable future, going to be very expensive. There are better tools every year, better software design tools, tricks to make languages inherently more secure. Or just pulling buffer overflows out of the programming language, for example. So there's a lot of stuff that's making it easier, but still it is very hard and very expensive. And I don't see any way around that, because we as computer network security people don't have a rigorous methodology. There isn't one. There isn't even a hope of one. Right? There is a lot of provable security research, but it's all still working only on toy problems. And I think it's going to be a long time before it can be applied to programs and systems of anything resembling actual commercial size, even for small software.
Bruce, my question is partly with regards to the information that you referred to that helps people understand what the reality of their risk is, but also for the general populace, I would put to you that a really important factor would also be the degree of laziness that exists. That most people just don't want to have to jump through hoops to be safe. Just show me a bloody green key already. And that to stand in front of a mammoth with a spear is like the antithesis of that. It takes a lot of gumption, it takes practice probably, for you to actually be successful. And that even in the case of the aviation industry, and I'm a pilot, so I found this particularly frustrating when I heard of it, that having the entertainment part of the computer system connected to navigation, that is unforgivable in the extreme, and that only exists because of laziness. I mean, surely just the information being really publicly available over time, my question is, do you think that will combat the just massive amounts of laziness that people really prefer to defer to because it's easy to be lazy in the short term and it's hard to be secure?
I think it'll help. It'll help in some instances. Right? And information is, again, the best weapon we have. So, I mean, there'll be times where the thing becomes public, it's so abhorrent that just the information will make it better. I'm not that optimistic because people are lazy. I mean, and it's not just lazy. I mean, it's the lemons market. I mean, in the United States, a lot of the security discussions turn into political discussions. And it's my side good, your side bad. Right? And that's the level of discussion. And yes, it's cognitively lazy, but it's still, that's the way people work because they don't have the expertise. I mean, the average person, take voting machines. The average person is going to say, yeah, computerized voting. Computers make things better. Right, let's get computers. Right? And that sounds right. And it's not that they're lazy and don't want to understand. It's that it's not their area. It's not what they understand. And it's very hard to say, I'm going to defer to the experts. Because unfortunately, the political situation is so polarized that there are now paid experts on all sides. So how do you find the real experts? So suddenly you've got a real problem because you have these agendas injected into what should be a security debate. So I think it's less laziness and more different skill set. And I don't think it's compatible. Compatible, right. And to the extent it is going to be information. So you're right about that. As to the airlines, and this is something is about Boeing trying to possibly link the internet connectivity, which I think is going to be horrible for airplanes because I just like not being connected to all you guys, to the avionics bus, right? Which just sounds, it's probably sensible to my mother. But you can imagine her working on a computer and suddenly gets the blue screen for, would you like to reboot this aircraft? It's like, no, no, no. Yes.
You were actually talking about the rational side and the emotional side of security and them converging together to at least some equilibria. But my question is, the further they get away from the equilibria, the further the feedback loop seems to be taking them either direction.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, as they get further apart, it's more noisy. So there's a lot more, I agree with that.
So my question was, is there something you actually see as a solution to that, as in, rather than just informing people?
I don't, sadly. I mean, unfortunately, it's a problem with this talk, right? I've got a whole lot more problems for you than actual answers. It seems like, you know, we're stuck with us as a species. is unfortunately a lot of the answer. So no, I think you're right. I never thought of it that way before, but as soon as you said it, it seems obvious, right? As the two diverge, they get noisy, right? So the swings between diverge and convergence are now greater and seemingly more random, right? And it then happens, only everybody's terrified. Or then nothing happens and everybody feels okay. You know, so it's just wacky wide swings. And that's probably right. You know, I mean, I guess you just wait for that to dampen down until, you know, people recover their senses. But again, I mean, the only answer I have is information. Right? It's a sloppy answer. It doesn't work all that well. But I think it's the only thing we have. Right? Either we give information or we manipulate the feeling ourselves. Right? Those are sort of our two options.
I'm Vic. My favorite security trick is asking people at the bank who are asking me my date of birth to authenticate themselves. How long do you think it's going to be before the level of technology that's available to the general public is basically going to make the physical securing of anything virtually impossible?
You know, it's interesting. I think that we're rapidly coming to that. It's a convergence of a couple of things. It's technology, and it's also the fact that more and more of our stuff, our assets, our privacy, our dignity, our whatever, is digital. Right? We have physical stuff, but we have a lot more non-physical stuff. So, you know, between that and the fact that a lot of our security systems have a digital component, mean that we're rapidly reaching a world where the digital aspects of security are much more important than the physical. And that securing the physical, you know, only goes so far. Now, of course, that's because we live in a safe society, right? We're not really that concerned about, you know, our physical selves, our homes. Those aren't the real threats. If we're living in, I don't know, Iraq right now, I'd be a very different answer. Because what we're afraid of, what our security risks are much more basic. But sort of living in a peaceful society, where a lot of those basic security things are cared for to the point we don't really worry about them. That the digital stuff, I think, is becoming much more important. All right, so that's it. I have a couple of things before I get off the stage. I brought a few copies of my latest book, Beyond Fear. Right, so this I also have, and it's in the back, and please take it, I don't want to take these home. This is the thin version of the book, I guess. Right, it doesn't have as many pages, but this one's free. And I do have three or four of these available if someone wants. I also, who here gets Cryptogram or reads my blog? Who would like to know this? Looks like about a third of you, a half of you. There's another flyer. I do a monthly newsletter called Cryptogram, and I sort of urge you all to sign up. It's just me writing about security. A lot of the things I talk about here I've written about in essays there. I can guarantee your mailing list, your name won't go anywhere on any list, and you won't be spammed at all. Or you can read it in a convenient blog format, which is on the other side of the card. So please do that. There are flyers on a table out of the door. I think some of you got going in. I'm going to leave some down here. Something will happen after I leave the stage. I don't know what it is, but it's likely to be interesting. So I think you want them to stay there and not...
Yes, we do.
Okay, so don't leave yet. Thank you very
Ladies
much.
Ladies and gentlemen, Bruce Knight. There was just one final question I wanted to ask Bruce. I didn't get a chance. Would you sign my GPG key? Now, one thing about LCA is that it's all about surprises.
Actually, Donna had a nasty surprise this morning. She walked into the room and there wasn't a single chair in the entire room. But now it's time... But now it's time for a good surprise for you. We have the Jim and Rusty show. So I'll hand it over to you two.
There are a number of motivations for what we're doing. Obviously, part of it is thanks to this community, and part of it, of course, is to recruit this community. Those of you who have or will be shortly getting OLPCs, this comes with some quid pro quos, one of which is to do really great stuff. Is this live? One of them is to do really good stuff, and another is if you can't, make sure somebody does. And then also I have a third request, which is this is the most childlike audience that I normally deal with. And there are certain experiments that Dave Woodhouse and I would like to perform having to do with children arriving at school in the morning. And so those of you with OLPCs, if you could check a particular website from time to time during the conference and maybe help us out by herding yourselves to particular locations at a particular time so we can do these experiments, would be greatly appreciated.
Okay, so we managed to get ourselves a handful of OLPCs. Then we had the problem of we need to get these into the hands of the people who are going to do, to use last year's phrase, awesome stuff. So we debated this for a long time. What's the most effective way of finding them? You know who you are, we don't. So in the end, we decided to do this randomly. And it's kind of a leap of faith, because we are hoping that by picking some random names out of the hat for this handful of OLPCs, they will, by osmosis, get to the people who have the ability and the time to do something great. So it's kind of like a gift the way a puppy is a gift. So I believe if we hit page down or something, we have a list of names. Could these people come to the front, please? I particularly like that we chose randomly Andrew, the human typo.
Also,
Just pass them along. Yes, these ones should be safe to boot. You'll see a URL on the front. If the other people don't show up, then and you can't hassle these guys to get it off them, then come and hassle us, I guess, in around lunchtime if they still haven't shown. Okay, thank you very much. I think, is there anything, final words?
Thank you, guys. Look after your puppies. And if you don't want your puppy, find someone who does. we have another surprise. Today is apparently the 10th birthday of Linux Weekly News. John Corbett, are you here? Can you come here, please? Now, Those of you who are actually subscribers, could you put your hands up? Would you please join me in a rousing rendition of Happy Birthday? One, two, three. Do you? Hip hip! Hip hip! Hip hip!
Well, thank you all very much. It's all very gratifying. I never imagined I would be doing this after 10 years, but some of us never learn. I'm glad to say that I guess it's about time for morning tea. We were able to kick in just a little bit and provide cakes, special WN cakes for the morning tea, which I haven't actually seen, but I'm told they are good. So I encourage you all to enjoy them. And again, thank you all very much.
One more thing. Anthony Baxter, are you here? Anthony Baxter to the white courtesy phone. Oh, Anthony Baxter to the white courtesy phone. No? Okay, well, I'll have to pretend to be Anthony Baxter. You are here. Do you want to say something about this business on Friday? No? Okay. Anthony is running our lightning talks this year. How many of you have been to OSDC, Open Source Developers Conference? How many of you think that the way they do lightning talks totally rocks? We're doing it that way. And Anthony's in charge. And he was going to say something, but now he's not. Apparently, they're 3 minutes. There's a board at registration. You write your name down, and if you're lucky, I think we have 15 slots, so they're pretty scarce, but they've got to be good. That's that now. The other thing is Hackfest. Is anyone here who can talk about the Hackfest? You're all in bed too? Damn it. We have a Hackfest. I know absolutely nothing about it. Go to registration and hopefully someone will tell someone there and they'll tell you and it will all be made clear. And that's it, unless I'm missing something, any of my minions? Anything else? Shaking his head? No, no. Well, morning tea will be served over at Economics and Commerce, where our registration desk is. Please enjoy it. Please think happy birthday thoughts for LWN and you OLPC owners. Take care.